Hello everyone, Goat Boy here. Congratulations to Dr. Pass for starting up the new Library of Horror podcast. If it's anything like Library of the Living Dead podcast, it's going to be a right scream, pun intended. Right, the thing I really want to get off my chest is Halloween 2 by Rob Zombie. I mean, what the fuck's going through that bloke's head? I mean, is it a remake, reimagining, go home and fucking rethink about it? You know what I mean? Because it's just dire. There's so many bad things about the film, it's a wonder it ever got made. I mean, it didn't even continue straight on from the first film like the original Halloween 2 did, you know, which made it a really cushy linear film. You know, Dr. Loomis is not the heroic Donald Pleasance, you know, knight in shining armour and yet flawed doctor coming to save the day. No, he's Malcolm McDowell. Now, I love Malcolm McDowell, I think he's brilliant and he's very watchable, but the character he's got to play in this, you know, suddenly from going from this child psychologist, this, you know, wonderful caring doctor who gave away 15 odd years of his life trying to sort him out, and then all of a sudden, bang, gets a book deal out of it, and he's running around and he couldn't give a flying fuck about anyone or anything. I mean, you know, no doctor would ever disclose, you know, personal information about a patient's family, but no, he gets away with it by putting it in a book. You know what I mean? It's just crap. Then you got Michael Myers, and all of a sudden his mother and an horse and a little Mikey start appearing to him. I mean, what the fuck's that all about? I mean, come on, he must... You know, one of the wonderful things about Michael Myers was the fact you didn't know that much about him. You know, it left a lot of why he did it to the imagination, which is the best thing. But now his mum's coming along on bloody Black Beauty, and, you know, it's just a... It just boggles the mind, you know. And then you got Michael himself. All of a sudden, he's become like this... He's gone from a normal size fella to someone who's like 7 foot something, built like a brick shithouse, great big beard, hoodie. You see his face too much. You know, you shouldn't see his face, in my opinion. That's what the mask's for. You know what I mean? And he grunts and growls, and suddenly he's got this psychic link to his sister, because now she's eating a pizza, he's eating a dog. Oh, she can taste Lassie and starts chucking up. I mean, what the fuck's that all about? It's never explained. You know what I mean? And it's just too much. I mean, you know, it's just another excuse, I suppose, for Rob Zombie to put his wife in a film. You know, yeah, okay, she fit in the first one, but there's no place for her in the second film. You know? And it's just so many inconsistencies, like, you know, when they find out Michael's about and the sheriff goes, puts a guard at the house of his daughter. No, bring her into the prison, you know, bring her home, lock her up, make her safe. Don't just say, oh no, I'll put some dopey prat out the front with a shotgun. You know what I mean? And then at the end, when Loomis realises he's been made a prat of on the Jay Leno show or whoever it was, I really weren't that interested at that time. And then all of a sudden he finds out that there's going to be a great big showdown. Oh, I know, I'll go and help. It's the least I could do. No, bollocks, it's absolute crap. And then, fuck me, to end it all, oh, there she is, in a cell. Oh, here comes Mummy and the horse again. Oh, and it goes round and round. And it's just, I wish he'd have just stopped, thought about what he was doing, gone home, punched himself in the face. Because, quite frankly, I'd rather have Dr. Puss drill 5 of my teeth without anaesthetic than have to sit through that crap again. Anyway, other than that, not a bad film. Bye.
The following is a story by Casey Quinn, found in the Library of Horror press release, Wolves of War. It's entitled, The Battle After the Apocalypse. The oft-repeated rule of triadic interaction is true. The enemy of your enemy is your friend. In the Bible, it's written in Exodus, I will be an enemy to your enemies and will oppose those who oppose you. Our enemy this day became our friend. Today, we put aside our days of spilt blood to oppose a mutual enemy. Where will this leave us after this common link is extinguished? Are we to be friends? I find it to be an impossibility and in defiance of the laws of nature. None of the survivors knew what this new world would be like. A world without tradition or restraints, placed by enforced rules of law. Just freedom to live. When the nuclear weapons were launched, chaos began. Almost instantly, a new world order was created. Within seconds, 20% of the world's population ceased to live. Within hours, another 10% was killed off. Within weeks, the population dropped to 10% of what it once was. Those of us who survived faced radiation, starvation, and dehydration. These three factors we feared the most when it all started for our community, when we first came out of our shelters. Soviet leader Khrushchev once said, "If nuclear weapons were to be used, the living would envy the dead." Never were truer words spoken. As survivors found each other in this world without power, without shelter, and without government, we formed small communities. We scavenged for supplies by raiding the remains of large cities. We formed in the countrysides and in the mountains, which still had greenery left. Doctors were rare, and those with injuries, a very short lifespan. Survivors on supply runs would find people buried in rubble, still alive, screaming for help, screaming in pain, screaming for our humanity. Just did not have the manpower to take them in. Without medical supplies, or even a competent doctor to treat them, what could we do with them? They would be a burden. They would consume what few supplies we had, what food and water we acquired, and would die anyway, even after all of our work. The injuries did not kill them. The radiation would, in their weakened state. They'd been in direct contact of nuclear fallout and breathed the tainted air. If they healed from their wounds, they were hopeless causes anyway. On a supply run to the nearby city of Clyde, I saw animals. Dogs whom had survived the apocalypse. Wolves. Foxes. They fed on the survivors we left behind in the cities and small towns we would come across. We noticed their numbers growing as time passed. They flourished from the remains, the corpses left by our selfish acts of survival, decisions that would later come back to haunt us. Odd things happened over the first few months. Our community of survivors underwent a great deal of change. At first, the idea of complete freedom was welcomed. Live how you want, without Big Brother telling you what to do and when. Total freedom. When we found the first body, things changed. The body wasn't just murdered, it was torn to shreds. We formed groups to search out the assailant, but we didn't find anyone. Only prints that led to and from the scene. Prints of an animal. Prints we saw leading to and from the remains of those victims we left in the towns and the cities. No one thought we would need guns or weapons of any sort when we gathered supplies. All of we survivors had seen enough bloodshed to break out of the desire to harm another person. We just wanted peace. We were naive in those early months. It wasn't every night that we would find remains of a survivor. In fact, it was random to us. Maybe once a month, the bloody remains of a friend would be found on the outskirts of our little village. Same paw prints leading to and from the scene. As months passed, we saw an increasing number of tracks around our village, circling us. With the increase in tracks, we found an increase in the number of the dead. One man said he saw his cousin Charles in the woods. He said he followed the paw prints from one of the dead bodies deep into the wilderness. He said the paw prints led us to his cousin, and he'd called out to that cousin, and then the cousin just ran away. His cousin, Charles, was one of the injured we left in the town of Petersburg, about 3 miles from where we set up our village. I remember it like yesterday. The wounds inflicted were deadly. There was no way the man had seen his cousin. The stress of the situation was getting to him. As supplies ran low, we would expand into new territories across the country. Some days we would find solo survivors in random towns. Mostly, we just found dead bodies, decayed and eaten. When we came upon the village of Postenkill, we saw more of the same. At least we thought it was the same. There were the dead bodies, and there were teeth marks in the remains. Yet, the scene was different. The prints were much larger, leading away from the bodies. The bites, smaller. Only one pair of legs, implying 2 legs. Not the 4 as we had come to know with our wolves. We were dealing with a different killer who shared the same tastes. We questioned the survivors of these small towns. They had to know. They had to have seen who did this. Most of them, though, had had emotional breakdowns. Men and women who 1 year earlier worked in a cube drinking coffee were now forced to fend off evil to survive. They were not built mentally to handle this stress. Their blood still pumped, and the instinct to survive intact. But it was as if they were in another world. Perhaps we all were. The stories we heard had claims of humans killing each other. Survivors exposed to the radiation. These survivors started to show up at camps in the wilderness, started to attack everyone and anyone, kill anything they saw. Those that remained assumed hunger had grown too strong, had transformed humans. Food was scarce. Most assumed many of these violent humans just regressed to cannibalism to survive. We gathered the healthy survivors from villages we found. They joined our society. We provided and shared what we could. Provided protection in numbers. Provided weapons we had collected along the way. As we passed through more villages, we felt eyes on us. Eyes watching our movement. And the subtle sounds of feet moving or words whispered. But no one was seen. We would lose members of our society in some of these villages. They would be with us, and in the morning, they'd be gone. Only blood remained in the spot where they slept. We assumed the enemy dragged the body away so they could feast on the remains, but there were no signs of that. No signs of a body being dragged. No blood trail. Like you would expect, just a pool of blood in the place where they slept, and then at some point, the body was gone. One set of footprints led to the body. 2 sets of footprints found leaving the scene. 6 months after the nuclear attacks, our society had grown too large to continue to move. It was time to settle in one location. Create our new world. I was selected as leader and went to work forming a community. Members would earn their keep in this society, work to stay alive in these conditions. Some were assigned to the army, while others were responsible for requiring food and water supplies. Depending on the skills of the person, they could be assigned to projects like building walls, structures for housing, and defense. As word spread of our community, we continued to grow. People from all over made the journey to join our new world. Tribes of men and women would arrive with a story of survival and loss of loved ones. At night, we would sit around a fire to stay warm, and those whom arrived each day would take the opportunity to introduce themselves, where they came from, how they came to be a part of us. Night after night, we would hear stories of cannibalistic humans who slaughtered wives and children in their sleep. Stories of men who would swear they stabbed these cannibals repeatedly without affecting them. Stories of friends being killed only to rise and join the ranks of the cannibals. Others would tell about an interaction with wildlife, of wolves attacking in large packs on random occasions. Wolves that in the morning would never be found. Wolves whose paw prints would turn into a man's footprint if he followed it long enough. Those of us who had been with the community from the beginning put the picture together. Those of us who left the people in the towns crying and screaming for help knew we were responsible for the carnage. We could have, at the very least, put the injured out of their misery. But we did not want to waste the bullet. Supplies were limited. Those of us who had been in the community since the beginning knew eventually these creatures of the new world would find us and kill us. After some time, survivors stopped showing up. They were either already with us or dead. This many months after the apocalypse, the percentage of individuals able to survive on their own would be next to nothing. There were too many factors for one person to deal with. We were the remaining members of this country, perhaps the world. Small skirmishes became normal with the cannibals. Many had taken to calling them zombies, or Z's for short. Our supply squads were hit the hardest. As we grew, we used supplies much faster. The supply squads needed to expand their missions and find new places to locate food, medical, and building supplies. We cleared roadways commonly used and stationed guards along the paths to protect our supply lines. Outside of those lines, when we expanded, we lost survivors. The Z's greatly outnumbered our community and would just pour on our position when they found us. They would follow the squad as it moved from location to location. The squad was trained to never return to our community if they had seen Z's on their trail. If they found our society, we had no clue if our stick-built walls would hold them off. We'd be sitting ducks, waiting for our supplies to run out. A squad reported an interesting find around our one-year anniversary of survival. They said they'd come across something they'd never seen before. Said there was blood everywhere, and carcasses torn to shreds, but not any of our friends. Bodies that had just been slain maybe hours before. Bodies with teeth marks, some with large bites, while others had the small bites. The bodies appeared to be those of the Z's and the remains of wolves. Paw prints running away from the battle. Footprints going in different directions. We were not the only ones at war. There was a battle for survival going on for everyone. Months passed with more encounters with Z's and less with the wolves. Our scouts found more dead remains of wolves scattered in the woods as they expanded their missions. We were losing more scouts as well. Our numbers were declining rapidly. We needed to expand to a new area, maybe relocate to the East Coast, but I knew we'd never leave this place. We would be open for an attack. We could never win against the Z's if we left these walls. Not with our enemies roaming, waiting for us out there. The Z's were on the rise, as we, the remaining survivors of the human race, were on the decline. We could only continue to scavenge supplies, build defenses, and live. The words always haunting me, playing over and over in my mind. The living would envy the dead. When the horn sounded this morning, I feared for the worst. Our time of ruling on this earth had come to an end, just like the dinosaurs had. The Z's had arrived to feast on the remains of we who had survived. But I was wrong. At the gate was a man I had never laid eyes on before, a man who had survived in the wilderness without our help.
"I'd like to speak to the person in charge here,"
he said, standing on the outside gate. Men, women, and children climbed the walls to get a better view of this person, this survivor, who had survived on his own. No one responded. They just stared at him. "I'm the leader here. Who are you, stranger?"
"An enemy who wants to be your friend."
Intrigued, I granted him entry into our community and spoke with the stranger. He revealed his true identity. He, this man, turned to wolf on nights of the full moon. He told of his own survivor story, of how he laid injured in a village pinned down on the day that the bombs landed, how he was attacked by wolves, how the radiation soaked into his body, how on that night of the first full moon, he changed. He transformed into a beast and was able to free himself from the debris. The stranger said many more like him found each other and formed packs. Those packs roam the woods and survive however they can, on whatever they can. The stranger said their days are now numbered. When they are the wolf, they're beasts, stronger than a normal person, vicious and powerful, perhaps even unstoppable. They could tear apart Z's by the dozen. But when the sun is up, and on nights there is no full moon, they were like us, vulnerable, weak, human. An agreement was reached today. The survivors in our community will protect the wolves who slaughtered us those early days and ever since for daylight hours. In return, at night, the wolves would use their strength, their hunger, to be forever at war with the Z's. This bond formed from a common enemy will unite us for now and extend our time on this earth, if only for a little while. What happens when the enemy of our enemy is no longer alive? When all that is left is our enemy, the wolf? I suppose that's a battle for a different time. The following is entitled Abandoned Bridges and is from the Library of Horror Press Release, Debris, a Collection, by Barry Napier.
When there is no fruit upon the trees, you'll find the hands of children fingerless. This is simple mathematics, really, for the trolls must eat. Myths and fables have them living under bridges, but this is inaccurate, a cleverly written literary disguise, older than text itself. They are residents of everywhere and everything, of the past and the ever after, and they must eat. We offered them our wheat, but winter suppressed our grain. We then offered them our mead, but they prefer to keep their heads clear. We then offered up our harvest, but they realized human gluttony as a sin. And in the end, the only fruit that we could offer was that of our loins. Tiny bones line the street, telling stories of dark afternoons, to which there is no end. We as parents weep and wail and ask our gods why this happened. our answers come in bountiful harvests and the prosperity in our fields, the greens and golds of envy and wealth, and the freedom to trip-trop over bridges that shadow the rivers that wash the blood of our children away.
Something for the rag and bone man over my dead body. Something big is gonna happen over my dead body.
Looking Back by T. Patrick Rooney. If you look back at my life and saw everything, even the embarrassing personal thoughts and feelings, you would wonder how I stayed out of this asylum for so long. You would rather want to understand why I ended up where I did, and you would most likely thank your various higher powers that there were no more like me around. It sounds like the beginning of some sort of novel, but sadly for me, this is really happening. And I've ended up here until death takes me, unsafe, unloved, and labeled criminally insane. My entire family is from Muncie, Indiana. I would say about 12 of my 18 first cousins still live there, along with various aunts and uncles. Very few have escaped the small town's clutches and found their way to bigger and better places. It all started when I went with my parents on a summer vacation to Norfolk, Virginia, to visit my aunt and her family there at the naval base. My uncle was a career naval officer and spent most of his years traveling the world in the bowels of an aircraft carrier. My aunt was one of my favorite people on the planet, and other than my mother, she was one human I could trust and tell anything to. We arrived very late one night, and my brother and myself slept on the floor. We were awakened by the sounds and smells of bacon cooking and coffee brewing. Breakfast has and always will remain one of my favorite times of the day. especially the unhurried, rare mornings where you get to linger at the table and enjoy the coffee. Of course, all that comes later. At this point, I'm 7 years old, and orange juice is the greatest drink in the universe. It wasn't until the following summer that I was introduced to the wonders of Kool-Aid. My uncle announced at the breakfast table that the whole family is going on a tour of his aircraft carrier. Sounded like fun to me to get to see where the planes take off and such. We happily drove down to the dock, and I must say, the lines of sailors in their dress blues and crisp salutes and such were very impressive. But the jets were fantastic. I learned that day that calling them airplanes was incorrect. They were jets. So we took the tour, we saw the mess hall and the barracks, we saw the giant elevator the jets rode up and down on. It was all very fascinating. There were several areas off limits to non-military personnel, mainly the bridge and the engine room and stuff, and of course weapons storage. It was awesome though. I was completely enamored, and I asked my uncle on the way up to the crow's nest, our last stop of the tour, what I had to do to join the Navy. After laughing for a minute, he looked down and noticed I was completely serious. So, we come out the door on the platform called the Crow's Nest, and he tells me that I would have to become 18 years old and be willing to go through basic training. Upon asking what basic training was, my uncle informed me that I would have to exercise and such, but also jump the tower. What's jumping the tower mean, I ask, completely willing to do whatever it took to join up right then and there. Well, it's like this, he says, and he picked me up under the arms and dangled me over the railings of the Crow's Nest. Looking down, I could see my sneakers dangling over what appeared to be white dots on the deck far below. I suppose if someone were to tell me that it was only 100 feet or so now, I would probably rationalize my reaction by saying that I was only 7 years old at the time. But as it stands, I was in fact 7 years old, and my uncle yells out over the sounds of the ocean and talking and horns blowing in the harbor that jumping the tower is about like jumping off the crow's nest. And with that, he tosses me up into the air. It was only a split second, I'm sure, but he caught me under the arms again and set me down. I had never thought the least bit about heights before that moment. In fact, up until then, climbing trees, the higher the better, was one of my favorite things in the entire world. At that instant, though, I was terrified. I don't recall a single moment in my entire life when I was that scared. He pulled me back over the rail and set me on my feet, and I collapsed crying. I was 7, and it was quite horrifying. From that moment on, my life was defined by the terror of falling. I was so worried about it that later, once we were back home, I brought chairs into my room from the kitchen table. I set them next to my bed so I could not fall out during my sleep. It got into my head so much that I would have dreams of wispy, ethereal creatures pulling me towards the side of the bed, trying to get me to fall in my sleep. My dreams were horrific from then on. I fell to my death thousands of times. They say you cannot die in your dreams, and they say you always end up waking up just before you hit when you dream of falling. Lucky bastards. I've hit thousands of times. I have died in my dreams so much that I begin to dread sleep. I started to loathe sleeping almost as much as I did tall buildings. At 12 years old, my parents, bless them, took me to see many psychiatrists and mental health specialists. They even took me to Germany once to a sleep clinic there. The sleep clinic set me up in a bedroom with cameras running so they could watch my sleep patterns and try to analyze why I could barely sleep and usually ended up falling from whatever bed I was sleeping in. The next morning, they ran the tape back for my parents and I and had several questions. Clearly visible on the tape at 3 different times while I was sleeping, you could see my hands to the side or tucked under my pillow, and yet a handful of my t-shirt material is grabbed by something unseen and pulled, and I'm pulled slowly, slowly, towards the edge of the bed until I fall out. They could not explain it at all, saying that I was a unique case. The next night, they insisted I go through it again with the cameras. This time, however, one of the doctors, Dr. Heidelberg, was going to stay in the room with me and try to see if he could stop my hands from pulling the shirt like they had the previous night before. You see, the doctors at this point were convinced that somehow I was doing it myself. They scoffed at my ethereal nightmared visitors and claimed it was all in my head. So the tapes rolled again, and the doctor sat in a chair at the end of my bed drinking coffee, all set to watch me sleep. Sleep was a long time coming that night. Eventually, I did drift away, though. The time code on the tape clearly shows that I started dreaming at around 12:30 a.m. At 1 a.m., the doctor gets up from his chair and grabs my t-shirt that was being pulled by something unseen again towards the edge of the bed. He stoops over my sleeping form. Both of my hands are clearly tightly clenching on my pillow when the camera's shot. He reaches down and grabs the material on my t-shirt and tries to pull it back towards me. His sleeve lurches and he stumbles, his face hitting the nightstand beside the bed, blood spewing. He falls to the ground and immediately screams loudly as he is dragged under the bed. He was never seen again. 2 days later, I was back in New England and locked here in this room, where I have been since I was 12 years old. It's been 8 years now, and the management of the hospital has changed over last week. The new council of doctors who run the place reviewed my case and determined that the previous administrators were inhumane in denying me a bed to sleep in. They looked at the video and didn't believe it at all. They scoffed and laughed, saying it was some sort of movie trick. They think the German doctors, at the request of my parents, rigged up the video so they could put me in here for life. I laughed in their faces. There is a reason I am here. It's written on my folder in big, bold letters at the top of the dossier. It's stamped, criminally insane. The German clinic said it would not press charges against me for killing the doctor, although there was never a body to be found. They said if I was locked away here forever, that would satisfy them. So, I was labeled criminally insane, therefore not able to be released, and locked in here. Well, I'm still locked away, but I didn't kill that doctor. Tonight, after my last meal, they're going to bring in a bed for me to sleep in. Great. The dreams have gotten worse over the last few years. I get the feeling that I'm about to go where the doctor is gone. We will see. Tonight. We will see. I'm going to stop writing now in my little journal the new counsel the doctors gave me. My meal is here, and after I eat, well, let's just say I don't expect there to be a tomorrow at all.
This short story was sent in by Stephanie Kincaid. It's called Bad Trade. I'm not ready to die. Craig's voice was strong, his carriage proud. The old man would have thought him terminal, but apparently death saw things differently. The process will cost you dearly, the old man said gently. My life means more to me than money does. The old man patted Craig's shoulder. The soft warmth of his gnarled hand surprised Craig. But that was silly, wasn't it? He was in the business of reanimation. Who knew how much life he'd infused back into his own musty bones? I speak not of money. If you wish to steal your essence back from death, you must offer him another in return. The ghastliness of the old man's suggestion, set against the kindness in his eyes, made Craig dizzy. Or maybe it was the medication. Look, I've seen these movies. I don't want to come back from the dead just to spend my life in jail because I killed someone. If that's your only qualm, you needn't worry. I'll give you 2 vials of untraceable liquid. One you must drink. The other you must pour into the food or drink of another. Any one will do. Death rejects no one. That night, Craig bought a cup of coffee for a homeless man. It was the most selfish act of his life. Yet, it was accepted with innocent gratitude as a gesture of kindness. Neither man lived until the morning. Craig could not know how much time had passed when he awoke, but he knew instantly that he had stolen back his life. Nothing ached. His head was clear for the first time in months. In fact, he was lucid enough to wonder where he was. He was quick enough to realize, when the hellish heat began, that he'd been saved from cancer, but not from the crematorium.
Thank you. bad, but the view is great. I'm living in a crematory. Prepare me for it.